This is episode 47 of Our Modern Heritage, the new home and family culture podcast. I'm Jody Chafee. In this episode, you get to listen in on my discussion with Connor Boyack.
You know, the big world out there outside of our house is scary and uncertain. What can really help is to have this strong foundation that we can absolutely get from family culture.
Okay, the word culture comes from the agricultural term, actually, of digging.
Kids or humans in general, when they are in the right cultural environment to grow up in, establishing the right conditions so what is already there can then grow more.
Are you preparing the path for your children, or are you preparing your children for the path?
Building a family is like building a business. Mm-hmm. We're just going to say, instead of creating a business culture, we're going to bring that into our homes.
Our vision is like the destination. It's what we want our families to look like. And I think family culture is the vehicle that gets us to that vision.
Giving that initial thought to creating something and then defending it, rather than always playing defense and hoping to kind of fix the broken pieces of our family culture from the ashes, is certainly the ideal. Okay, well, what is our family culture and what is threatening it? You don't. The biggest thing I think of when we talk about topics like this is you can't win a war that you don't even know you're fighting.
Connor Boyack is president of Libertas Institute, a free market think tank in Utah. In that capacity, he has spearheaded a number of successful policy reforms in areas such as education reform, civil liberties, government transparency, business deregulation, personal freedom, and more. Connor is also president of the Association for Teaching Kids Economics, a nationally focused nonprofit training teachers on basic economic principles, so they are empowered and motivated to help their students learn more about the free market. A public speaker and author of over a dozen books, Connor is best known for the Tuttle Twins books, a children's series introducing young readers to economic, political, and civic principles. Connor lives near Salt Lake City, Utah, with his wife and two homeschooled children. Welcome, Connor.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it. That's a lot to read.
Yeah, I stumbled over that a little bit, but
no, it's all good.
It's awesome. I appreciate that you're working on spreading the message about, you know, understanding the economy and the free market and things like that. My family, we own the first group bundle of the Tuttle Twins books.
Cool.
I haven't gotten the newest ones yet, but so
it's
far
hard to keep up with them.
Yeah, that's good, right? That's good. Keep pumping them out.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome. So tell us more about this inspiration behind the Association for Teaching Kids Economics.
So that organization is a recent one. We set it up about a year ago. And the whole idea was, as we started selling the Tuttle Twins books just directly to people who wanted to buy them, we came to the conclusion, you know, a year and a half ago, that that's all well and good and awesome, and it's spreading really well. We just passed over 200,000 copies sold. So it's a fun milestone. We're doing well. But came to the realization that we're never going to get ahead of the curve. We're always going to be behind getting the books to families who kind of already have this worldview. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that in the schools, children are not being taught free market economics. They're not being taught the principles of a free society. The curriculum just doesn't even talk about these things. And so we wanted to kind of get in, compete, expose kids to these ideas, because they're certainly being exposed to alternative ideas. And so we at least wanted to start supplementing curriculum and school material with these resources that could help kids learn these ideas when maybe their parents would not have heard about these books or not purchased them otherwise. If they're sending their kids to school to be exposed to all these ideas, let's at least make sure that this perspective is being offered up as, you know, one way to think about the world around us.
Can you give us like a short kid version of what free market means?
Yeah. So, you know, the way we explain it to kids usually is that a free market is many people working together in pursuit of a common goal. So the story that we use in the Miraculous Pencil book, for example, is that pencils require all these people working together. Even people from different countries and different religions all end up working together harmoniously or positively in order to produce this item. And so the free market is really that people are freely interacting with one another. They can decide whether they want to work with other people or not. And it's in all of those decisions you get something called spontaneous order, where there's no president of pencil production. There's no czar of iPhones. You know, people left to their own choices determining who they want to work with and how and where and when, they end up working together in pursuit of making amazing things that benefit our lives. And so the free market is really just people being able to work with those who they want to work with to come up with some fun ideas.
How is that different from what message is being taught in schools?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first off, it's not so much that there's always, people tend to think that in schools there's this nefarious, liberal, progressive indoctrination. And when you look at the literature and the textbooks and stuff, there are what I would call sins of commission. In other words, teaching bad ideas. And in fact, I bought a book fairly recently, a children's curriculum textbook used in many states. And it talks about how great the government is for, you know, offering healthcare and childcare and all these things. And so I would call that an act of commission where they're teaching, in my from my perspective, wrongly, that the government exists to do all these things for all of these people. And so you do have sins of commission, but I think more often what you have is sins of omission. In other words, the curriculum does not even introduce these ideas as a school of thought. It does not even expose children to these ideas. And so it's in the absence of that information that kids either form their own ideas or from peers or from culture and media, and they adopt these perspectives that are not necessarily correct or true, when if we had simply exposed them to this other worldview and these ideas at a younger age, they and their families may have said, you know, yes, that's what we believe. I'm glad I've kind of found a way to articulate that. And now they have kind of this foundation against which they can, you know, defend their ideas against kind of this onslaught of other ideas out in the world. So more often it's the sins of omission, and we're just trying to supplement and get in there into the conversation. Sometimes we do have the commission where they are teaching ideas that I think are counterproductive or incorrect.
Okay. So what would you say is your mission to accomplish? What ideals do you want to help these kids to develop?
Yeah, for sure. So really we see the economic way of thinking as a way to answer personal, professional, and you know, cultural and political questions. When you think about the ability of people to freely interact with one another, to make choices, make rational choices about themselves, to not be forced into choices that they think are counterproductive to what they want to do or what they can afford. The economic way of thinking really helps equip a child and an adult with the ability to understand the world around them. And so where school is all about, you know, helping children make sense of the world, teaching them reading, writing, arithmetic, and so forth, we think that economics needs to be in there. And if you look at even states that have like Common Core, for example, they'll have one of the long list of curriculum requirements is to teach economics. And yet it's not really being done. And when it's being done, it's not being done well. Many schools are doing like junior achievement or financial literacy, right? What is money and banks and businesses? But that doesn't get to the underlying philosophy of economics and helping people understand that economics is really just answering the question of how people interact. And whether you call that social or political or cultural or whatever, it's really all economic. And so we want to help kids empower them with these tools of rational, critical thinking that are arrived from economics. And of course, we do this at a very simple level. It's not like this is a master thesis on, you know, economics or anything. But we want to empower that critical thinking that we think comes from an economic way of thinking, an economic perspective on life. And so that's why we're trying to get in there with some fun stories so that we can help introduce kids to these ideas.
So it's really like a philosophy. It's a life, like you say, it's a lifestyle way of thinking. It's a philosophy that you're trying to introduce mm-hmm. to the kids so that they're not necessarily assuming that, you know, because I think there's like this script, right? That people are going, okay, you got to get good grades. You got to pass all your tests, and then you got to go off to college and make sure you get a good job and then contribute to paying off your debt or contribute to society or the stock market, things like that. Yep. I think that we just kind of go along with all of that without questioning or wondering, is this really going to benefit me? Or how is this really going to play out in the long run?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think there's a conveyor belt. I was on it myself. Yeah. And, you know, people don't really understand that kind of the cultural and historical pressure to go down the same path that everyone has trod before it's very strong. And for a parent who maybe wants an alternative perspective, or, you know, every parent wants the best thing for their child. The problem is there are so many systemic pressures to say, we've taken care of it all for you. We have this babysitting service called school. Go ahead and take your kids here. We'll take care of it beginning to end. You don't need to think about it. Go focus on, you know, your business or whatever's going on. And so those pressures, those are incentives. That would be the economic term. Those are strong incentives that lead people down that same path. And you have to have alternative incentives or different reasons. Maybe they're moral or religious or cultural, to consider alternative ideas. And what we're trying to do really with our association is not, you know, we get into public schools, private schools, charter schools, homeschool co-ops, and so forth. And so really for us, it's about kids are everywhere. However they're being schooled, whether they're on the conveyor belt or not, we want to reach out to them, because what we found is that parents, even parents who believe these ideas, struggle to figure out how they can talk to their kids about those ideas. And the books are a very helpful resource in that way, because now they can read a fun story together. There's a point of reference for the parent to say, hey, do you remember in the story when this happened? Let me help you understand that a little bit better. And so we're just really trying to equip parents and teachers to have these conversations at all.
Yeah, that's definitely what I think I've gotten out of your books so far, is that it is a conversation, and it's something that's gotten me thinking and my husband and I talking. And then as our kids grow up and begin to understand these concepts even more, it's allowing us to have that conversation to just, what does all this mean?
For sure.
we're part of something bigger, and we want to help our kids understand that we want to be producers, really, ultimately, is our goal.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that our society and our culture at large is so, you know, this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, is how we're so consumer oriented, where we want to, you know, so much of how we cope with things, how much of just the way that the media that we watch, it's all about consuming and owning things and having this and that. And so more and more, I've been thinking more about this concept of being producers, and not necessarily in the sense of being entrepreneurial, which would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, just being able to be producer in the sense of, I want to learn how to do things, or to cope by creating, or,
sure,
you know, things like that. So anyways, that's just something that in this whole idea about the economy and your mindset and things like that, we want to ask, you know, what is it that I can do more so than what can somebody else do for me? You know, because you can never consume enough in order to be happy. But when we have this give and take and this, you know, back and forth of services and goods and things like that, then mm-hmm. we have a more functional society.
Yeah, I completely agree. And again, for a parent, you have to question, what does the system encourage?
Yeah.
Right? Is the current system encouraging what you just articulated, or is it are encouraging maybe the alternative, a more consumption mindset, instant gratification, gimme, gimme, gimme? And that's not to say that people within the system are necessarily aware of that or purposely pursuing that. I know many amazing people in, for example, the public school system who are well-meaning, trying their hardest. But when you look at kind of those incentives and the system itself, it's very hard. And so a parent who wants to be very diligent like you and say, I want to encourage a production mindset and let's contribute to society, create value for other people, that I think is incumbent upon the parent, regardless of the schooling system that their kids are in, to say, we need to be very diligent about finding the ways to encourage our child to do this, setting up incentives for the child to want to learn about that and want to do that. I'll tell you briefly as a quick tangent. In our state, last year, we launched the Children's Entrepreneur Market, which is a summertime series of farmers markets run entirely by kids. So you get like hundreds of kids showing up, all selling all sorts of stuff. But when you get the profit motive in there, and when there's an opportunity for kids to earn some money by selling food or clothes or art or toys or games or whatever, that provides a really important hook for parents to begin talking to their kids about, well, how do you set prices and what is competition?
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you market and how, you know, why is hard work important? And so those incentives allow for the production mindset to come in, because the parent now has a vehicle to begin having those conversations with their kids.
I love that. Awesome. So let's see. I'd like to go into some more about this idea about family culture, because I think this all relates. We've been talking about parenting and also education and things like that. So what are your thoughts about family culture?
My initial thoughts about family culture is that it's very hard to not be affected by the culture around you. I know many good families, you know, if you think about it from like maybe a Christian religious sense, there's the whole like Babylon mindset of like not taking on Babylon and kind of having the having your kind of spiritual religious truth in your family and not, you know, having the stain of the world around you come in. But But I think, you know, whether you approach it from a religious perspective or not, let's be very clear that the culture is constantly changing. There are very strong pressures for people to kind of be part of that culture. And a parent who wants to be very proactive and emphatic in creating their own family culture, chances are someone who's pursuing that type of thought or project is not wanting their child to just be a sponge and absorb, you know, the culture of our society. And so you have to not only be, I think, diligent in figuring out what do you want your family's culture to be. So we can be very emphatic in setting up defense mechanisms that we want for our own child, right? To say, I want to make sure my child isn't exposed to this, or that they have, you know, the opportunity to, you know, do service or whatever. But then as a parent, I'm being a little hypocritical if I'm trying to create culture for my children that I myself am not willing to pursue. And so am I, you know, if my daughter's trying to play, get me to play a game with her and I'm, you know, oh, sorry, Instagram is, you know, beeping at me. Let me go see what's going on. That's a strong temptation. And so I don't think we need culture just for our children. We need a family culture where we are all participating, where we are all invested in it. And the thing that comes to mind when you ask that is there's creation and defense, right? We have to create our family's culture, and then we have to defend it against maybe alternatives that are hostile to that. Not to say that we don't want to be exposed to alternatives and be open-minded and you know kind and tolerant and all those type of things. But what I believe is born in part by the thinking that I have with the Tuttle Twins books, right? And what we're doing there. Or even you think of something like sex education in the schools or with your children. If you don't teach your children that type of material, whether let's say it's sex education or economics or political philosophy or whatever, if you don't, somebody else will.
Yeah.
Right. And the problem is, especially if you wait too long, then someone has already reached them and the kids are thinking about it that way. Now you have to kind of overcome and correct and provide counter information rather than having that foundation. And so the challenge that I see with family culture is that parents are not necessarily giving it, generally speaking, enough thought early on where they can be very diligent in setting that foundation so that they proceed in a good direction. I find many times parents are playing defense rather than offense, right? Something has happened, or the kid heard something or saw something or has a friend who does something a certain way. And we're always just playing defense, trying to fight against it. And again, I'm not on a pedestal here. I struggle with this as much as any parent, but I think giving that initial thought to creating something and then defending it rather than always playing defense and hoping to kind of, you know, fix the broken pieces of our, you know, family culture from the ashes is certainly the ideal. The question is, how do we do that? That's obviously very time consuming, a lot of mental energy, but at least thinking about it and having conversations like this, I think are important because it's going to lead to a lot of productive efforts by families to say, okay, well, what is our family culture and what is threatening it? Like, the biggest thing I think of when we talk about topics like this is you can't win a war that you don't even know you're fighting, right? And so if you think that like there are enemies out there that are trying to affect you or your children, when there are temptations and there are struggles and all these things that are that we have to navigate through in life, if you don't recognize what they are and where they are and how to counter them, you're losing. Like you can't walk into a battlefield ho-hum, ho-hum without armor and defensive weapons and everything else. And so that's where I think parents can, generally speaking, do a little bit more to say, okay, maybe life is more a battle. There are these influences. How do we be very emphatic about protecting our kids and ourselves as adults from them?
Yes. You just totally summed up like my whole mission of why I'm doing this whole podcast. You know, it's like you do have to be intentional. You have to be emphatic. It's not good enough to just coast through and omit the things that you know, like you said, there's this omission aspect of mm-hmm. the way that we parent that we have to be more conscientious of, that if we aren't giving it to them, then somebody else will. You know, if we aren't the ones that are being on the offense to try and create that stuff, mm-hmm. then they're going to seek for it somewhere else. And so it's not good enough to just go, okay, well, we'll just see how it turns out.
Right.
You know, we got to
roll of the dice.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that's been like my whole message is, you know, get clear about what your values are and then come together, because we all have to come together, like you said, and agree. And then as parents, model that for our kids. So as parents, and we model, and if there are values and things that we want them to have, we need to adopt those things and work towards those things ourselves.
Agreed.
And then allow them to follow in our footsteps. Okay, so what are some important values that you see are things that families can adopt to shape their family culture?
Oh, good question. Okay, the first thing that comes to mind is curiosity. I think it's a better approach when a parent is learning with a child rather than teaching to a child. And so curiosity about the world around us, I try, if one of my children asks me something, I'll say, well, let's go look it up and learn together, right? Rather than, here's the answer, and I'm going to teach you that answers you seek can be spoon-fed to you. And, you know, like, I want them to develop critical thinking and inquiry and curiosity. And so that has been a fun thing for us, to kind of create a culture of asking questions and being curious and, oh, I don't know, let's go on a field trip, or let's find a YouTube video, or, you know, let's, because I think that's something that you can equip a child with for life, that is a strong life skill that's going to benefit them. Another thing that I think of is service, you know, and the reason I say this is not so much, and not only, I should say, for the actual direct impact of helping another person, but it kind of is connected to curiosity. When you serve another person, you are opening yourself to that other person's life experience and problems and circumstances, especially if you get into any international type service and you're helping your children become aware of the plight of, you know, people in impoverished nations and these big questions of how do we solve this and what has led to us, which delves back into economics and politics about, you know, government structures. That I just heard a woman in, I believe it was Senegal last week, I heard her story about, she was trying to set up a small business in her country, and she basically had to go get all these permission slips and spend thousands of dollars and wait all these months just to even be allowed to set up a business. And you think of what that does, right? And how it perpetuates a lot of poverty. And so these service, I find, is a good hook, because you get kind of the serotonin or whatever, you get kind of the effect of, you know, doing good and helping other people. There's certainly the charitable religious aspect that comes in, but I really love that it helps open people's minds to the world around them. I think we have a tendency too often, even with social media exposing us to all these different things out there, of having tunnel vision in the communities that we're in, the circles that we're in, the life that we're in. And I think that's a detriment to my children. I want them to be aware of things around us. That's why I really like that pencil story, thinking about how all these people around the world are required to help with the tiny little common pencil that we get. We'll do this exercise from time to time with my kids around the dinner table. And we'll say, okay, where did the meal today come from? Right? What's kind of the family tree of our meal that landed in front of you? I don't want my kids to have instant gratification and entitlement and all these problems that our society kind of leads to. I want them to be open-minded enough to recognize all the people that had a hand in that meal. You know, the farmer and the truck driver and the grocer and the banker and everybody working together. How amazing it is that we live in a world where we can get fruit that's out of season, shipped from half a world away, you know, across an ocean by people whose language we wouldn't be able to understand. Like, that's amazing when you think about it. And it creates humility and it creates awe and curiosity. And so I find that, you know, service and curiosity, these connected concepts really help. And, you know, I mean, it's the other challenge, of course, is that when you're co-parenting, right, when you have husband and wife, you're working together, it takes two to tango, right? And especially, so you want someone, ideally, that you kind of share those same values and you can kind of create that culture together. But the hard thing too, and if I'm being very honest, you know, culture in our family is 90% my wife and 10% me. Right? And so I can have all these grandiose ideas. So a few years ago, I wrote this book called Passion-Driven Education. And the whole idea is that you build curriculum and educational ideas around what a child is already interested. So rather than then you saying, like, you have to learn math, someday you'll, you know, need to know the quadratic equation. Instead, you're helping the child understand interests they already have. You're helping them make sense about the world that they are already curious about. And so it creates a much more productive and valuable education experience. So, you know, I write this book, I go around speaking around the country, I'm talking to all these people about these ideas and whatever. And my wife sits me down one day and says, you know, that's not how it really works, how we're doing it in our family, right? And, oh, well, you know, yeah, like, you're doing 90% of the work, you kind of have your own ideas about how we're going to educate kids, to the extent that I have my like 10% of time in doing the education with our kids. This is how I'm trying to do it. So, you know, it takes two to tango. You have different ideas there, but I think at a minimum, you have to be having these conversations. You have to be figuring out like, okay, here's an ideal. Maybe we're not going to attain the ideal, but how do we go in that direction? And how do we be kind of diligent? And I think what matters is kind of the directional, approach rather than we're perfect. And we now we're trying in this direction. We're not perfect, but we want to pursue this culture. We're going to be trying. These are our goals, and having those family goals. So, everyone's different. Everyone's got different ideas. For us, I want my children to be open-minded about the world around them. And I think when they understand these things, it's going to create life purpose for them. It's going to help them see their place in the world and opportunities where they can create value. But I don't want my children to go on the conveyor belt and be narrowly focused on their own grades and their own self-interest and these kind of short-term things. I want them to have an expansive view about the world around them. Yeah, we're going to do all the short-term stuff of learning what we need to and helping them grow and mature. But when they're an adult, I don't want them to suddenly be thrust open into the world and say, good luck adulting. Yeah. I want my children to be prepared for that. And I think how we're diligent now and kind of creating that culture and that family approach is very important. Again, every family is different. No one's perfect. But I think what is necessary is having these conversations to figure out what are the family goals and what is the culture we want to strive for, even if we never quite get there.
Yeah. I've heard family culture described as like the vehicle that takes you towards your vision. And it's really that vision that's really so crucial. And whatever that vision is for your family, those influence that vision influences your day-to-day habits and your norms. Yeah. Things in your discussions and things like that. And like you said, just coming together to agree on what that vision is. And so then the vision is what shapes your values and your activities and
totally.
And the principles that you live by. And so it's really just getting clear on that vision is so important. I think that's really everything you just said. It's really like if your value is helping your kids be open-minded, then what your vision is having a child that's open-minded. And so each of the things that you implement in your day-to-day life are working towards that vision. How does teaching kids about economics and our free market serve our family culture?
I guess I would just point back to the example I gave a few minutes ago with the pencil, right? Because when we talk about kind of this economic way of thinking, it helps people realize the world around them is an intricate place and all these people are working together. And I think that's going to trickle down into like, hey, people are out there with different values and different government systems and different philosophies and worldviews and everything else. What is our family? How do we fit? What are we wanting to do? And so I think just being aware of the world around you and trying to understand how it works is going to allow you to find your place in your family all that much better.
And I think that too, if that allows your kids to have a bigger, broader picture. And when you are teaching them about that in your family, then that helps them to see A, that they're part of something bigger and B, that we need to be unified in what we are doing as a family. And it helps, I think it would help my kids when I think about it, kids to be more mature about this whole being a part of something that it starts in our families. If you want your kids to see that the world is a bigger place, then you got to see first that they're a part of a family, and I have a little son that he is very self-interested and I'm always like, dude, we all need to work together here. We all need to get along. And so it starts right there in our families going, we're a part of something right here in our home.
Totally.
And then expand that to understanding that we're also a part of this larger world around us.
And examples like that are helpful because you're connecting it to a bigger principle. We lose opportunity, I think, when we fall into the temptation as parents of saying, because I said so, right? Or because you have to. It could be a teaching moment to say, well, we're structuring it this way because you'll understand a little bit better as you mature. This is the way, the world works, or this is what you'll have to do as you get older. Those are, I think, really important teaching moments to instill that culture rather than just doing it by force and saying, you got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. It totally changes the dialogue.
Yep.
So in this light of, our families, starting with our families, being understanding we're part of something and then a part of something bigger, how do you feel like teaching and understanding our family culture, how is that going to impact and shape our nation?
I think what we've lost in our day is the tradition of sitting around the dinner table and having a conversation. And I think that's due to many reasons, and we're all crazy busy with schedules and sports and activities and extracurricular everything. But, I think the conversations that we have on a national level are a reflection in the aggregate of the conversations we're having, or for that matter, not having, you know, in the home, and developing, you know, different perspectives, even within your family of like, yeah, well, my dad thinks that way, but I don't, but I'm now going to learn a little bit of tolerance and compassion and love because this person I care about, I see is not evil simply because I disagree with him and so forth. And so when you lack that kind of homegrown experiential process, I think in when you expand that out to the nation, we're a lot more short-tempered, we're a lot more critical, we're a lot less forgiving and tolerant of others. And, you know, I just think that people are often critical of, you know, politicians and so forth of not representing us and doing the wrong things and whatever. But I think really in the aggregate, the people who are our quote-unquote leaders are a reflection of us. And so if we are not living, you know, moral lives and having civic virtue and, you know, tolerance and all these kind of things, I think, you know, that that gene pool and that like voting pool is going to lead to people who kind of have those same virtues or lack thereof. And so I think, you know, it's kind of trickle up politics, right? Where we have to start at the grassroots level and be dialoguing better and be experiencing different perspectives better. And really, at the end of the day, the biggest problem, I think, on a national level is, especially from a budget perspective, is just welfare. How many people have become dependent upon the government or their neighbors, taxpayers through the government, helping them because they can't or won't help themselves. Now, obviously, there are, you know, the safety net situations, people who simply can't. However, I think we miss out as a community, as families, of not taking the opportunity to directly help one another. I'll tell you, when I've done some service projects, and I get to see that person, look them in the eyes, understand their plight, be able to help them rally together with neighbors or church members or whatever, it transforms us. It bonds us. It helps everyone in that transaction. And when you do it through the government, unfortunately, you lose that connection and you don't know who you're helping or being required to help. And you just, in those incentives again, you increase dependency because people can get, you know, free money for nothing. So I think to your question, this idea is by not addressing things as families and communities, by not reaching out and helping other people and serving those around us and working within our spheres of influence, well, obviously there's still people with problems and needs. And so they turn to the government to help. And we lose that opportunity to have very strong, closely knit communities where we support one another. Everyone is just looking to the government instead. And we can look throughout history, you know, this does not end well when you have this much demand on budget resources and this much welfare. It's not to say there aren't problems that need to be helped, but I think where we lose that family culture and those community values and outreach and support, the aggregate impact of that is what we're seeing today, where there's just a massive drain on our budgets because of the increase in welfare, people just looking to the government to solve their problems rather than looking in their communities and families for support.
What other books do you recommend that can help teach us about the principles of economics and government?
That's a great question. Most families, in my experience, who aren't already inclined to really dig deep in this stuff are intimidated by you know, these thick treatises on economics or politics or history. You know, we're busy. We don't have a lot of time, especially for the moms. The mental energy is just drained. It would be very hard to sink into this, like, you know, thick, deep academic type book. Yeah. And honestly, this is one of the sneaky things with the Tuttle twins, and not intentionally so. We did not go into this with this idea. It's a happy accident where with these books intended for children, what we're finding is that the parents, of course, are reading along for the bonding experience, or the kid can't read themselves or whatever. And so we're reaching the parents themselves along with the kids because it's a bonding experience. It's fully illustrated, right, which makes it easy to read. And so there we're exposing the parent to these new concepts that maybe they've never really understood. They've never read these books before. And so the Tuttle Twins is a really kind of fun way to introduce these ideas, even to adults. Now, it's not a book, but it's an important resource that I think is also helpful to understand economics a bit more. There's an organization that we've partnered with called FEE. It's the Foundation for Economics Education, FEE.org, F-E-E. And what they do brilliantly, so they're focused on like the high school, college age, and then adults beyond that. And then we work in the K-8 space. That's why we kind of have this partnership together. What they do brilliantly is using current events and culture and movies to explain economic ideas. And so, for example, you might go see the new Avengers movie, right? And so everyone's talking about the Avengers movie, and they might have an article that says, you know, what the Avengers movie taught me about economics, right? And so you use this hook where people are like naturally curious because they just watch this fun movie. They speak that language now that they understand the plot and everything. And because they speak the language of Avengers, they can understand an economic idea framed in the language of Avengers rather than reading the language of economics, right? So that's brilliant because you're using language and vernacular that people are familiar with, these concepts and ideas that are in our you know, zeitgeist in our culture, and you're introducing economic ideas to people just in article bite size so you can subscribe to it. They've got a podcast, whatever. So I would say for those interested to learn more in economics, start with Fee. They'll point you to other resources. There's certainly books out there for those who are interested. They even have a recommended reading list. But the best way to kind of get led down that path a little bit, especially for someone new to it, I think would be recommending Fee, just starting to read some of their articles, get familiar with the concepts, and then see where that leads.
Awesome. Thank you. I just actually recently stumbled onto that site. So I'm glad to hear a second witness.
Awesome. No, that's awesome. Great.
Cool. So tell us what is your URL? Where can we find you?
So we post a lot of our stuff on the Tuttle Twins website. You can find certainly all the books there. If you use the coupon code 40, F-O-R-T-Y, you can get 40% off our books there. Our association's website is atke.org, A-T-K-E.org. That stands for the Association for Teaching Kids Economics. Or if you're curious about me, you can go to connorboyack.com or just Google my name. You'll be able to find out plenty. We'd certainly encourage people to reach out and follow what we're doing.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Connor.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening. I love getting your feedback. You can like, rate, and share on your favorite broadcasting medium or social media platform. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at Family Culture Podcast and on Twitter at @_FamilyCulture. Come check out my show notes and resources at homeandfamilyculture.com. Thanks again for listening. Mother Teresa once said, "If you want to change the world, go home and love your family."